And we'll have some, Barry and I will have some dialogue. And then we'll open it up for Q&A and discussion. So.
Before we start with your questions, Max, someone asked me how we met, and I wasn't all that sure of the answer. I was assuming it was in San Francisco at a Zen teachers meeting, but you weren't a teacher then, so I didn't quite know what happened. What's your recollection? How do we know each other anyway?
Our connection runs through Stephen Davidowitz.
Oh my goodness, that's right. Young Steve Davidowitz, that's right. I forgot
So,
part of the story.
Steve and I were monks at Tassajara together in 2004, 2005. And Steve was a it was a student of Barry, right? And had come from New York City, and you had kind of sent him, didn't you send him to the monastery
Yes,
or something?
well, the story was that he couldn't really make it in lay practice, so we had him institutionalized. We sent him to the monastery where he thrived for many years.
Yes, that's right.
You befriended him there. That's right. That was the connection. Now I remember that.
Yeah, and I remember that I think I had read your first book, which would have been out by then, right? Ordinary Mind, and around 2004 or so. And then I was saying, Steve, this is a great, and he said, "That's my teacher." And and then I think I connected with you when I become, because I'm originally from Brooklyn, so I connected with you when it was coming out on visits to New York City.
In New York before we met in San Francisco.
We did, and I don't know if you remember that. I guess it would have been around 06 or 05 or 06, probably 06. My wife, who was not my wife at the time, and I came out to do a sesshin with you in Garrison. And I like to tell this story, and my wife is happy to share it, that we were all sitting, maybe some of you have been to Garrison, to this, to kind of that retreat center. And we were in one of the smaller rooms, maybe because we were a smaller group. And my wife was seated, her position in the zendo was in front of a window. And so she had this lovely view of the gardens and the fields. And then when she came into Dokusan with you, you said, "How's it going?" And she said, "Oh, it's great. I have this great view. It's beautiful." And you said, "That's cheating." So then, so that, yeah. So I think that was how we started knowing each other.
Remember the sesshin, but I don't have the, I can't order my memories chronologically. So didn't know what came before what. So that's interesting. 2006 or so,
And at that time, I had a shaved head and was very much in the monastic sort of form of things in some way.
But I guess I got the idea that you were impressionable and talking to, so something clicked.
And it was very, and I would often come to New York on my way, because I'm based in the San Francisco area, and I would come to New York on my way to do long retreats at IMS, Insight Meditation Society, which is kind of this sibling center for BCBS. And it was always good to meet with Barry before and after and get my mind washed out of all the get my head turned back on straight from what I was doing. So, well, so my first question is a little bit connected to that, is I think in the in the traditional Buddhist teachings, there seems to be a pretty clear picture of what freedom is. And the way freedom is a freedom from, it's a freedom from the suffering that comes from our grasping and clinging and attachments, as we've talked about. And I get the sense that you're presenting, we've had a number of different visions of freedom or pictures of freedom from the readings and talks, but I get the sense that you are presenting, a different picture of freedom. And so I just wanted to ask you to elaborate on that. And then, what's the role of suffering in this? What's the role of attachment? How do you see all of this mixing together?
I was losing the connection there for a bit. I hope it's back.
Oh yeah, now you're okay. It was frozen for a bit. Did you hear the question?
Yes, asking me about these different notions of freedom. The folks at Ordinary Mind know that we've done a lot of reading and discussion, the work of Isaiah Berlin, another philosopher, who's written about two kinds of freedom, which he calls negative freedom and positive freedom. And the negative freedom is more what we refer to as freedom from, and is that kind of freedom from constraint of one kind or another, whether you conceive of it as internal or external. But positive freedom is freedom too, which is a kind of developmental freedom. It's the kind of freedom you get when you get an education. When you go to school and college or professional school, you develop skills and capacities that enable you to do all sorts of things you wouldn't be able to do otherwise. So that there's a kind of freedom that needs to be enabled by circumstance and training, opportunity and connection with others, and embeddedness in a kind of system. And it's a little bit like what you were describing with my old student, Steve, who when he was on his own, he was too much on his own, and he was sort of at loose ends. And his life was very chaotic as a result. But the monastic life
Did we lose Barry? Oh, okay. Okay, I think we were just getting to the good stuff.
Is that better? Am I back?
Yeah, that's better. Yeah.
I just went blank there for a little while. So the monastic community, as well as the monastic discipline, provided a structure that made him free in all sorts of different dimensions. It allowed him to flourish, develop. So that's a whole other dimension of freedom you could say it's the freedom that railroad tracks give to a train, right? Being free of constraints is not the only criteria. You have to have all the requisite structures and factors in place in order to do what you do. So, right now this whole setup enables me to be a teacher. Without that, I couldn't function. And that can take place in people's lives at all sorts of different levels. And it can be in terms of a formal discipline or practice. It can be in the form of a relationship with other students in the Sangha or with the teacher that gives them validation and encouragement. Can have to do with the teaching themselves. But I think certainly from that developmental and psychoanalytic perspective, I feel very attuned to that side of freedom that requires opportunity, not just a lack of constraint.
There's a popular Dharma book called Happiness is an Inside Job. And it sounds like you're saying freedom is not just an inside job.
Not just inside. I mean, and that's part of what I hope people would get from Hagelin's book and the readings about Hegel, is that who we are is not an inside job. Right, it's who we are is all about our embeddedness in relationship and community and practices, which we have this complex reciprocal relationship. We're both shaped by them and we help shape them. We're conditioned and we do the conditioning, and the freedom is the conjunction of all these conditions that allow us to function optimally and flourish.
Well, and it sounds like that with this picture of freedom, freedom is not in opposition to attachment.
No, that this is attachments, in fact, are commonly a condition of freedom. Certainly in my psychoanalytic lineage of self-psychology, Koha talked about self-objects. And that was one word where another person serves a kind of function that helps you be you, allows you to feel understood, recognized. Their presence can stabilize you or regulate you. And that the absence of these kinds of needed relationships can leave people feeling isolated, unknown, feeling like their lives have no meaning or impact on anybody else, so that a whole sense of what we are can depend on having the right kind of attachments. And I think that that word gets misunderstood or misused when it is transferred over into a Buddhist context, where it's almost a pejorative, as if any kind of connection like that is simply clinging and a failure to be autonomous and independent the way a real grown-up should be. Right?
Yeah. And I mean, this was one of the things I wanted to ask you about. The words clinging, grasping, attachment are sometimes used interchangeably. Mm-hmm. But as earlier today, there was this suggestion of a distinction, or I guess I made the suggestion of this of a distinction between clinging that is extra, that's not needed for our functioning, that we can let go of, and versus kind of healthy attachments. And how do we draw it? Do you see that's a valid line to draw? Where do we draw that line? And the example that I was saying with you is, I'm a parent, And I certainly have a strong attachment to my young daughters, but I also have lots of strong attachment and clingings to my own views, to my own confusion, to my own, you know, what's the, you know, I know some of that clinging, if I let go of, I'll be more present, I'll be more responsive, I'll be a better father. But it doesn't mean I want to let go of my love for my daughters. So yeah, how do we work with
that? First of all, there is that whole layer of loving attachment, right? That is the parenting relationship that is absolutely necessary, not just for her to develop as a child, but for you to develop as a parent, right? That attachment allows you to grow into whole dimensions you wouldn't have a chance to explore or discover if you weren't in that relationship. Now, I think that the depth or intensity of that attachment is not the problem. The issue, I think, is more one of the a problem of control, and that I think that this can manifest either as a sense that the child is an object that you need to control, that you want to have behave a certain way, that you have an idea of what good behavior is, or what normal development is, or what respectful behavior to a parent is like. And some of these things are part of what a child can learn from a parent, but some involves, I think, the problems arise when the parent doesn't really stop to empathize with the child's subjectivity, doesn't know how to stop and see things from the child's perspective. And then you get stuck in these modes of trying to control the uncontrollable, right? You're trying to make this child's development fit into some predetermined box of what a good child is, right? And then, you know, you create problems both for the child and for yourself. So in some extent, there's a problem of preconceptions about what normal or good is. In part, there's a potential problem about what good behavior is, how much noise a child should be allowed to make, how much mess they're allowed to make, what they should do in school. I mean, all these notions are conceptual boxes. And in a sense, the danger is clinging to an idea of what good or proper is, right? It's not... the clinging is to a picture. It's not that you're too attached to your daughter. You may be too attached to a picture of what a good daughter is supposed to be like, right? So that makes it for a different kind of clinging, right? It's not to the object itself.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of clinging is the kind of clinging that we can let go of, and we can see through practice and become more aware of.
Well, either through a therapy practice or a meditation practice, we might be able to see that we have a perspective, and that perspective is not simply common sense, but is our own idiosyncratic view. And there might be other views that where things could can loosen up a little bit. As I think I was saying to you before, though, so often, you know, these things change involuntarily. They only change when you try to make something happen and just fail at it repeatedly. Right? And you just finally get the idea that that's not going to work. And so you more or less, by default, find yourself in a position of letting go of control that you used to think was absolutely essential.
And so this is the wearing down kind of, so many times you bang your head against the wall and eventually you, or...
Right. What's going to give? It doesn't seem to be the wall, right?
Okay, so a question about what does it mean? You know, I've heard this term, to suffer intelligently. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to suffer intelligently? You've talked about being dependent intelligently. And what's the alternative to that? What's the suffering?
Well, suffering intelligently was Joko's phrase, and it was the suffering of that's entailed in simply staying with things as they are. That when we encounter things that we habitually try to avoid for one reason or another, something that makes us anxious or angry or scared, through a certain kind of discipline, instead of trying to avoid those things or push them away, we can willingly just stay in that moment and suffer the thing that we thought we couldn't deal with, that we reflexively said, I can't bear that, I don't want to go there, you know, that's too much for me. Why should I have to? Whatever it is. And there, it's a suffering of just letting ourselves face the thing we were avoiding. And it's intelligent suffering in that it goes against the grain of habitual conditioning about what's possible, what's not possible. And it allows you to wear down those that conditioning or those reflexes, right? It's when it goes well, a session gives you a chance to suffer intelligently, and it allows you to see that you can stay with and function in the midst of all sorts of situations you might have thought were too extreme to handle or something like that. And it just expands your range of saying, oh, okay, I can feel that. I can go through that. The unintelligent suffering is the suffering of avoidance, and the suffering that comes from trying to control the uncontrollable, the suffering that is a kind of... sort of the suffering of I fought reality and reality won. You know, it's the suffering of beating your head against reality, of not wanting to deal with, no, it's really going to be that way. So there, it's a suffering that colludes with your expectations and ideas about what's possible and what you can stand and all of that, or how people should be. And doesn't lead anywhere. It just, it's the suffering of spinning your wheels. I think as a corollary to that, some years ago, I began to speak about being dependent intelligently, with the idea that dependency is a necessary and normal part of life. Interdependency is one of our realities, and that we are as dependent on each other as we are on oxygen. But to be dependent intelligently is to be dependent that recognizes mutual vulnerability and recognizes mutual subjectivity, that the other person has their own needs and vulnerabilities that correspond to ours. And they're not simply there as an object to fill a gap in our life, right? That they're not controllable and manipulatable simply, or you could say reducible to a function, right? I think that when you try to reduce a whole person to a single dimension function, you do violence to them and to yourself. The need is real, but you're not handling it intelligently.
Do you think there is there's a bias in Dharma circles towards aiming for a kind of autonomy and independence, and I'm going to get to a place where the world is this kind of messy, unfair world is not going to be able to hurt me?
I think that's a very basic curative fantasy that a lot of students have and a lot of teachers collude with, you know, that the practice will breed discipline and endurance and toughness, and it can promote a kind of asceticism where there's an apparent paring down of needs so that it looks like you're able to live a simple, close to the ground kind of life without a lot of frills or, you know, unnecessary wants. But I think that all that can be in the service of denying a lot of emotional reality and the actual need for love and intimacy and someone that you can be vulnerable with and dependent on. And I think that it's the shadow side of a lot of what happens in Buddhist centers of all stripes, that dependencies that are unacknowledged come out in addictions and sexual scandals and problems of around authority and submission. And I think these things, when they're not addressed directly, play themselves out in the shadows.
Maybe this is a good segue into this idea of practice. It's but certainly in the early Buddhist vision of as a path of purification, you know, Visuddhimagga, is what, you know, translated means path of purification. And so purification and renunciation, how do you see, how do you see these, what's the alternative? What's the place of renunciation in a householder's life? What's the place of, you know, is there a role for purification?
The short answer is probably no. Purification itself may be a contaminated idea, a kind of inherently dualistic picture of life in the world that wants to separate out the pure and the impure. In a certain way, it's that kind of dichotomy that I think practice is supposed to overcome. It's certainly a basic notion in psychoanalytic theory that you want to just let all sorts of thoughts and feelings come and go without this kind of notion you're going to separate out the pure from the impure and somehow get rid of the impure thoughts or feelings, so that you're going to purge yourself of lust or anger or jealousy or anything else. I mean, I think Freud's whole enterprise was trying to allow in what was repressed as impure. Right? So one of my maxims is the mind is not defiled by its contents. We're not here for a purification project. We're here much more to try to develop a healthy ecology of the mind in which everything is allowed to develop in its own place in an appropriate kind of way. I think there's certainly ways in which people can become unbalanced. You know, it's a good metaphor for someone who is whose life is preoccupied with greed or resentment or a kind of chronic sense of lack or craving for attention and recognition. All these things are byproducts of healthy needs that have gone unmet, often locked in a closet where they fester and develop into rather ugly forms. And so they need a little fresh air and sunlight in order to get transplanted back into a kind of healthy ecology. So I think that the whole metaphor of purification or is something that I think we need to try to get away from. I think that renunciation is a slightly different story in that it can be paired with something like discipline. It can mean being able to live within certain bounds and structures. You know, if somebody who's always used to having their way and doing what they want when they want to do it will experience staying within any discipline as renunciation. Right? So in that sense, what's renounced is the grandiosity of feeling like I should be able to have it my way all the time, right? So that's, in that sense, that kind of egocentric view of things has to rub up against the grindstone of reality. And that can feel like renunciation. But the point is not really to valorize chastity or asceticism necessarily in their own right.
I guess one more question from my side, and then maybe we can open it up. Mm-hmm. But the just a question about on the one hand, transformation. I mean, you've been practicing for many decades, and you've been accompanying students for decades. What are the kinds of transformations that you see occur over time in practice? And, you know, maybe to say something about the ways that the form of practice or the model of practice, understanding of practice, conditions that, you know, transformation, or, and what are the pitfalls? You know, I talked about this kind of model of progress, and, you know, I think there's some beautiful benefits, but there's also a lot of pitfalls in that. And, you know, just curious, you know, in the model that you're talking about, where can things go awry? What are the transformations that are possible, and where do things go awry?
Yeah, it's always a good question to ask, where do things go awry? If you want to know how something works, it's also good to know what, you know, what can go wrong. What's on the side effects label, right? See, I think that for me, the transformations of practice have to do with ending a sense of lack or deficit, that kind of basic sense of not okayness or I'm not there yet. And I think that that's what I look for in students or somebody who's going to potentially teach, a kind of ability to really just say, this is me, warts and all. Not that they've finally perfected themselves, but that they've not seen themselves entirely in terms of problems that are endlessly needing to be fixed. You know, I think it's a drawback of Joko's approach that it felt like an endless project of self-improvement sometimes. That you know, this sense of you were just endlessly working on yourself. There's always this edge of anxiety here or anger there or something that, you know, some thoughts that were always to be labeled and so forth and so on. And it was very valuable practice in one way, but there was no sense of ever being able to feel like you've arrived. That this was it, right? In some ways, she was saying all of it is it. This is it. This is it. The anger is it. The anxiety is it. That was there if you could see it. But a lot of students, I think, turned it into a kind of endless project. I basically stopped having most students label their thoughts because it became something they were doing well or badly at, right? And most people felt like they never could label their thoughts officially and couldn't catch up. And they were like that old show of Lucille Ball and the Chocolate Factory. They were all coming at them too fast and they couldn't keep up and they were always missing one. So I think there's a real kind of transformation when we let ourselves get off that treadmill or hamster wheel of self-improvement and really allow yourself to be just as you are for a little bit, right? That's why I called that second book Ending the Pursuit of Happiness. So I think there's a way in which practice can give that set, really give you that sense of this is it, and that I am not a imperfect or failed version of something else, right? That I ought to become someday. Right? Now, the downside of that potentially is too much complacency about flaws that other people see or things that you're doing that are not helpful. My partner Jessica says that that for me enlightenment simply has made all my neurotic flaws completely egosyntonic. completely comfortable being how I am without any incentive to change anything, you know. So for her, that's a perversion of enlightenment, right? So that's the ditch on that side of the road. You know, on one side, it's this endless day late and a dollar short project of self-improvement. And when I hear you talk about the Theravadan approach, it just gives me a rash because it makes me feel like it's, you know, it's this endless ladder and you're never going to get to the top. You know, I've just felt like everything I've done is to not get on ladders like that ever again. And but the other side, the other ditch can be this complacency about blind spots. And that's where you have to be willing to listen to other people and pay attention to the impact you have on them.
Well, it goes back. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And it's almost like we come full circle and it goes back to the need for others. Yeah. And not only to help us actualize who we are, mm-hmm. but to be mirrors for us and to, you know, where, what am I not seeing? And,
And as teachers, we have to pay attention to what's actually helpful. We can't simply just dispense what we think is right and true. Occasionally, we have to pay attention to whether anybody's listening.
Oh, great. Yeah, thank you very much. And
Now we'll open it up and we'll find out, you know?
Yeah, let's see what's resonating for you. Should I just, maybe we'll do the raise hands feature and I can just call on people. So Stephen.
Hi, thank you. My question is pretty simple question. Pretty probably hard answer. I have my own answer, but I want to hear your answers. Knowing better and still not doing it. So example, something as benign as shopping because I want to get that sudden dopamine hit of I'll feel more comfortable, sense pleasure, I'll buy this thing. And then it's another stupid thing coming on Amazon that I don't need. I don't want to waste my money on. To the bigger things, like my daughter says something very selfish and I, in the moment, I can see it. I can see that I'm going down the wrong road and I still say something that's unhelpful that I regret and spend time apologizing for the next day. I tell her she's spoiled or whatever it is. So even in the moment where I'm mindful enough to know better that this is not going to work, I haven't convinced myself it's going to work like back in the day when I would just blindly go ahead and do things and then only very later realize it. Even in the moment, I still go ahead and not always, but often do the wrong thing anyway. So here's a self-improvement project. Here I'm on the ladder, endlessly trying to make myself better. So Barry, if you could address that or anybody and let me know what you think of that. I mean, how can I do what I know I should do instead of just doing the wrong thing sometimes?
Well, we're all slow learners in that way, in the sense that we think we can see the right thing to do, but we don't do it. Certainly Joko's approach to that would be to say, just try to pause for that extra couple seconds and try to identify the thing that you're trying to avoid, the feeling that you don't want. When it's a matter of shopping, that kind of restless urgency or whatever it is, don't fight it. Just try to actually feel what's at stake. Try to understand that. And then go ahead and do it. And then just see if feeling it the next time lets you tolerate it a little longer. And maybe the next time you'll wait 30 seconds before you hit send. And maybe the next time after that, you can wait a minute. So that's one kind of way of thinking about it. Just see what really feels like it's at stake. I think that you know, with other people, in part, it's also a matter of a practice of empathy, of switching your perspective to how does this look or feel to the other person, rather than what is it that I want or need in this moment? And that shift, just consciously, habitually shifting that perspective, slows you down, makes you react less reflexively. But there's no simple answer to this. I mean, people spend years in therapy and years on the cushion trying to be aware and wear out habitual patterns. It seems like there's nothing permanent in this life except our bad habits. Right? They're the one thing that never changes, right? So it's, I guess I would say, though, that the point is to try to bring awareness to it, not self-castigation. That's rarely a good motivator. But it beyond that, I think it's an individual issue that you have to work out with a therapist or a teacher. It's hard to have a general rule for these things.
Okay, Henry.
I have a question for Barry, if I may, but Max, I just wanted to tell you that Ross Blum says hello.
Thank you.
So Barry, you mentioned positive and negative freedom. And I'm wondering, you know, there are opportunities in this country for everyone to maximize their capacities. But at the same time, there are very real material and structural constraints. And I'm thinking of Hagelin's, second half of Hagelin's book discusses Marx. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in your ideas about Marx's idea as presented by Hagelin in terms of material and social structural constraints on our freedom.
Well, I basically agree with that analysis, that there are social, structural, societal restraints on freedom that have to be addressed socially and politically. You know, it's a matter of taking responsibility for the social institutions that are responsible for those constraints and working to change them. Mostly that's not in my job description to be doing that, but I agree with that as part of the bigger picture. And I think it's important to recognize that as part of the bigger picture so that you don't project all of society's problems back into the individual and say that if only you practice the right brand of mindfulness, you'd be able to overcome all these obstacles in life. I think that's a kind of the kind of thing that Ron Purser was talking about in his book of McMindfulness, where you know, if a big corporation has terrible labor conditions and bad pay and all sorts of structural problems, the solution is not just to have everybody take a mindfulness class to reduce their stress. You would like to also allow them to be able to join a union. And so it's important to recognize what are external factors and not just assume it's all a matter of personal liberation.
Do you think Western Buddhism puts too much of an emphasis on individual psychology rather than a more social relational perspective?
Well, again, it's sort of like it says, it's what's under our purview. It's the part we have some influence over. As a therapist, as a Buddhist teacher, I can work with people on their part of things. I think there is some increased tendency towards engaged Buddhism to address those political, social factors. Again, that's not really in my bailiwick. I think that if I emphasize it, the personal, it's simply where I have some expertise and where I'm able to do most of my work. But I agree that all that is out there and shouldn't be eclipsed by the personal.
But you're a relational psychoanalyst as well, right?
But not so political.
Yeah. Well, I have more, but I want to give other people a chance.
Thank you, Henry. Parnell?
Barry, I'd like to ask if you could help me to understand better really what's meant by the term Buddha nature. I get the impermanence, I get the interconnection.
Then you've got it. That's it. That's it in a nutshell.
But it has a positive quality to the words. It suggests something that's a do-gooder kind of quality.
Yeah, that's a mistaken interpretation. And Buddha nature is sometimes mistaken to mean something like your intrinsic Buddhahood or your intrinsic capacity to be enlightened, as if it's a little jewel inside to be uncovered. I think that's a mistake. I think we should think of Buddha nature as the recognition of these two basic principles of Buddha's enlightenment, of impermanence and interconnection. This is what he realized. And you can say that the positive connotation is that, like Hagelin says, that we recognize these not as flaws, right? That these are features, not bugs, not problems. Right, this is just the nature of reality. See, it connects to something I've talked about a lot before, where I say that it is our practice not to discover some hidden true self deep inside us, but to simply discover the truth about ourself. The truth about ourself is that it's impermanent, it's empty, and it's interdependent. That's its Buddha nature. True self doesn't mean that we have a luminous inner enlightened essence waiting inside. If we can only polish the dust off the mirror or scrape the rust off the surface, so it'll be revealed underneath. We're not looking to reveal anything underneath. That's why that book is called Nothing is Hidden. So Buddha nature, like true self, or the truth about the self, is what everything already consists of, but that we deny or resist or simply don't see.
Thank you.
Malcolm, and then Linda, and then Michael.
Hi, Barry. Thanks a lot for this fantastic class. Just one quick question on the Hegelian sort of self, constructing the self through others. Is there a connection there that you can make to the anatta, no self, or the, as you say, the original face or the sort of true self? Can that, you know, because obviously the no self is maybe the harder to understand, of course, than the impermanence, etc., as we always say. And is this sense of we can only be understood in terms of our relationship with others, could that be a way, do you think, for us to understand our no self, you know,
as well? Yeah, that's right. The no self doesn't mean that the self is non-existent. It means that the self has no permanent, essential, unchanging core or essence, right? What is it? It's like everything else. It's impermanent and interdependent, right? So we can say that one way of understanding the self is it's not this core me deep inside, right? It's not a something that is only known through introspection and is not available to anybody else. But the self is context all the way down, right? So that the idea of intersubjectivity and no self really are saying the same thing in somewhat different languages. I think that, again, there's a misunderstanding of no self to think that this thing is, the self is non-existent rather than saying it's impermanent. The self is empty in the same way the table and the chair is empty, right? It's a material thing subject to change. The self is just like that. And Hegel's description of it as interdependent is really an idea that dovetails very nicely with Buddhism. Good point, thank you.
Thank you.
Linda? You might need to unmute I don't see you, Linda.
Thank you. Barry, I meditate in order to, as you said a little while ago, not see myself as a problem. But when I listen to people like Richie Davidson, who was speaking on the Dalai Lama's program this week, he talks about, he and many others, of course, talk about meditation causing or resulting in changes in one's brain, even epigenetic changes that can actually, in effect, make us better people. And I secretly hope that something like that's happening. Is that kind of cheating?
Probably. I mean, in a certain sense, to say it makes changes in the brain is just is a tautology, because if you're not a mind-body dualist, you're saying that anything that's happening in your consciousness is reflected at some level in your physiology. I don't know that I would want to talk about permanent changes in the structure of my brain, but I suppose I've had permanent changes in the structure of my knees from meditation, so I suppose it could have affected my brain too. But I don't think we need that level of description at all. I think that in meditation, you simply see whether you are better self-regulated, whether you are more disciplined, if you are more self-accepting, if you're less emotionally reactive, if you're constantly involved in self-improvement projects like listening to tapes of the Dalai Lama, you know, all these things are bad signs, you know. So the ability to give these things up that is a sign of real progress.
Michael?
Hi. So I wanted to ask about the title of this retreat, the course, about human nature and Buddha nature. It's somewhat of a follow-up from what Cornell asked. Is there a difference? Is human nature, Buddha nature, are they the same? Are they different? And how can something have a nature if there's no essence? That part is very hard for me to comprehend.
Yes, well, it's deliberately set up as a kind of false dichotomy, right? It's like the mu koan, does a dog have a Buddha nature? You set the problem is posed as if you're trying to equate opposites. But not only are they not opposites, as you say, they are no thing at all. There is no essence to either of them. They're both simply characterized by impermanence and interconnection. And so what we're aiming at is a recognition that one way or another, we always create these dualistic dichotomies that we have to become aware of and then dissolve.
Yeah. Is it a function of language? The fact that language is imprecise and can't really describe what we're talking about?
That's a complicated kind of question, whether dualism is inherent in language, or you could say it's, in one sense, it's inherent in biology, that the most fundamental distinction in life is between an inside and an outside. You know, like a single cell organism exists because it's got a membrane to separate out something in the inside from the soup it's floating in outside. So in some sense, it exists only in the context of its surround, but in another sense, it's defined only by difference and separation. So living at that cusp of interconnection seems to be a reality of just being alive, of what it is to be alive. Language, of course, can make it much worse, and we can get involved in all sorts of philosophical and psychological projects that are specifically aimed at dividing the world into things like pure and impure, and then turning meditation into a purification project, and so forth and so on. So we can, I don't know if we can eliminate it, but we can certainly make it worse.
Thanks.
Allison?
I guess there's a couple things. I was sort of, Troy, again, struggling with the notion of that there is no essential nature, but I understand that in the sense of not being permanent, but there does seem to be essence of different things, of people, and I'm not sure how to describe that and how one would talk about it. The other part is, in light of this way of describing Buddhist path that you are describing, what would spiritual bypassing be? Like that term comes up a lot, and I've been trying to understand.
Yeah, well, spiritual bypassing, I think, was coined by John Wellwood way back when, and it, in psychoanalytic terms, we would tend to call that dissociation. It means, in a certain sense, compartmentalization or splitting off. And in our practice, it usually means cultivating certain particular states and thinking that they're one way or another going to drive out others, right? We can spend a great deal of time trying to be calm in our practice without ever really looking at the roots of our anger or what triggers it, right? And we can use meditation to try to build an ideal self and think that if we do that enough, we never have to deal with the other messy stuff directly. I think that one version of that that was very popular when I started out was the idea that a big enough enlightenment experience would be a kind of universal solvent for all neurotic tendencies. There'd be this top-down approach in which this big white light would just, illuminate all the dark corners and drive away all the demons, and you never would have to deal with them directly, right? Sort of like trickle-down economics made spiritual, right? It became the main reason that in my generation there was this necessity of bringing psychology into the picture with spirituality. I mean, when I started out, teachers would talk about that's merely psychological, and that's not our realm, and we don't have to deal with that. And a few years later, when they literally got caught with their pants down, people started saying, maybe we have to deal with that. So in one way of talking about it is to see that there's no separate realm of the spiritual and the psychological, that there really is just one mind that we have, and we're not trying to divide it or work in one sector of it rather than the other.
Would it also relate to some sense of like, oh, I am like so spiritual, and in a way ignoring like those political economic realities, like as if, because I meditate and I do these things and I'm aware, as if that's going to resolve things that could be systemic and.
Yes, that's another kind of dissociation, to think that you can live on your island and that it'll be safe from the encroaching sea, around you. That's right.
But in terms of no essence, like there's still something, and I don't know whether it would be a physicist or whatever, that there's essential natures of, there's some things, there's energetic.
Well, see, that was the original dividing line or distinction between Hinduism and Buddhism. Is Buddhism said that there was no essential nature, that it was empty all the way down. And if you look at something like the Heart Sutra, it says, no eye, ears, no tongue, body, mind, no realm of consciousness, no realm of, so forth and so on. It's sort of asserting there are no atoms of experience, right? Mm-hmm. It really, that everything is simply context and relation, right? And nothing can be, an easier way to think about it is to say that nothing can be defined except in terms of its relations to other things. Right? So that if I try to say who I am, I say I'm a teacher, I'm a father, I'm a New Yorker. But every one of those definitions involves other things and other people. there's nothing I can say about myself that is free of some history or context or relationship, right? So that's one sort of, you know, experience near way of thinking of no essence, that everything you try to think of as a definition of who you are relates to other things, other people, and the world around you.
Terry, and then Hope.
Thank you, Barry. I want to talk, ask about intersubjectivity, this sense that a self is conditioned by everything else. So in a sense, we're never alone because we are so much a part of everything else. But in another sense, we're always alone because we can't really communicate precisely our experience. So we have feelings of existential aloneness. We have feelings of isolation. Is that just a misperception?
It might be something of a misdescription in that it works from a model that says who we are is this inner experience that we struggle to communicate to others, and that we can only do it imperfectly through language, and no one ever really knows what's going on inside me, who I really am. And so that's basically a Cartesian picture of what an analyst, Bob Stallaro, called the myth of the isolated mind. To think that we start from these separate inner essences that struggle to communicate to each other. And the idea would be something like that is, in fact, a breakdown product, that it's when you feel misunderstood or disconnected or not recognized, that results in a sense of that incommunicable innerness. And everybody suffers from that to some degree or another, but it's not a picture of an original position so much. It's a picture of how things fragment when the intersubjective fabric is torn. We could go, there's a lot we could go into with that. Is that enough as a short answer?
Yes, thank you. It sounds like what you're saying is the default, or that maybe the healthy state is one of wholeness and connection. And when that breaks down, we feel isolated.
Yes, I think that sums it up.
Thank you, Hope. And then Michael Cocott.
Oh, thank you. Hi, Barry. So I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about how, probably like many of us, I was raised in a religious tradition that surprisingly was not Zen Buddhism. And because of kind of the strictures around it, because of the inability to feel, I guess, like myself within that religious tradition. At a certain age in my early 20s, I became a seeker, you know, and found my way very early in life to Zen Buddhism. And as I've gotten older and continue to practice, it's interesting. It's like I find myself interacting with people from very, very different religious traditions and relating so easily and like so feeling like, oh my God, we're exactly the same, you know? And I will talk to Mennonite Christians, which is who I grew up with, about the concept of grace. And I would be like, my mind is blown right now at how close we are to each other, you know? And while I get it on one level that it's like, oh, that's because of something, you know, like in my practice that I have opened up and I don't feel divided in the way that I did when I was younger or whatever, but I'm less concerned about that. And I'm more curious about, I often nowadays found myself being like, so what is this that I'm doing in Zen practice? And is there something unique in Zen that leads to a certain place that other religions don't? Or is it just like sticking with the one that you have and going for it with gusto? I'm just curious about your thoughts.
Well, I think it's wonderful that you can feel that connection and openness to people from so many different faiths and practices. I think you're much more enlightened than I am in that.
Well, I'm from Ohio. You know, that's what we do. That's what we do in Ohio. Uh-huh. Well, sort of. Maybe not. Maybe not.
You know, I don't think that it's as if you know, all religions are aiming at the same thing and they're all just different paths to the same source. I don't think that's true. I think that there are very different cultural and psychological and spiritual outcomes from different paths. I think that, but it's also true that I don't think that there's any single or unique, you know, insight into life and death that, you know, only we have and nobody else has a glimmer of it. Mm-hmm. It's sort of my reaction sometimes when I talk to people who've been involved in, you know, in intense monastic practices, you know, of great intensity and discipline and endurance or asceticism. And there's something admirable about that, but I don't think that sort of the great matter of life and death is understandable only by spiritual triathletes. You know, it ought to be something that is, you know, out on the table for everybody who lives and dies to come to see and come to terms with. But in the, you know, in the same way, there's something unique about what we do. And I suppose, I think it's like picking what instrument you're going to be in the orchestra. Mm-hmm. You know, are you the trumpet or are you the violin? You know, you both could be playing in the same orchestra and playing the same music, but you're going to have a different kind of experience, and it's uniquely yours. And I think this Zen path is one that, for whatever reason, has suited us for the last few decades, and that we have an opportunity to transmit, but also an opportunity to transform, to make it something that suits us, is perhaps more inclusive, something that is better able to communicate with other people, maybe make us all more like Midwesterners who are open to others. I don't know. That part hasn't worked for me yet, but
it's a tall order.
Stuff, but you and Claire embody that that wisdom.
The few and the proud, yes.
Yeah. It's always a couple who attain that. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much,
Michael.
Thanks. G'day, Barry.
Michael, what time is it where you are?
Sorry?
What time is it where
what
you
time? Are? It's nearly noon.
Noon
on Sunday. I've gone through the hard yards of from midnight onwards, so I've managed to survive so far.
Thank you so much for being able to do that.
Well, the pleasure's mine too. Yeah, thanks. But the pleasure feels mine for being able to experience yours and Max's teachings and together with everyone. I just thought of something I'd like to float past you, because a lot of what we've been sharing and talking about kind of seems at least potentially accessible to reflection, but you know what you call the intersubjective fabric being torn. It often happens before. At such an early age, it's before memory comes online developmentally, and then this sort of thing, the those things start to play out perhaps in our lives, in ways that are hard to grasp, and we struggle to perhaps. Shed light on the causes of our experience of pain and suffering. Although we can certainly perhaps see the effects of it. So I wondered what your thoughts are about how and how much can Zen practice help us to work through trauma experience before that sort of reflective memory came on board, and whose origins seem sort of eternally hidden to us. What do you think about those sort of thoughts?
Well, I think that, as you say, trauma is fundamentally about rupture in the intersubjective fabric. Something that leaves a person feeling damaged and separate. And it's almost by definition, the sense that their experience is not knowable to someone else. It leaves you with that sense of ineffable or incommunicable inner harm. And I think that both psychotherapy and Zen practice offer different ways of trying to reweave that intersubjective fabric to make a person feel connected and understood and embedded again. Certainly, you know, a lot of these traditional stories of old Zen teachers, you know, are stories of people who became monks because they were orphaned at a young age and lost their parents and abandoned in poverty and left at the monastery someplace. And so you imagine children, you know, who have been terribly traumatized or bereft, being taken in to this new cohesive family world where life is ordered and meaningful. And I think that in some sense, it's the restoration of a cohesive, lawful world through that kind of communal practice that is restorative to people. Mm. And in psychotherapy, it's restored through a personal relationship that is reliable and understanding and dedicated to repairing of ruptures. And I do think that some of that pre-verbal sense of damage is repairable, and that a sense of basic okayness is achievable through these practices. I don't know that you can talk about trauma being eradicated, but I think you can. It can come to be seen as a containable, bearable, communicable experience within a cohesive self, and something that doesn't inexorably separate you out from the human tribe, right? Mm. So I think that kind of restoration is possible and does happen. Mm.
Just a little, thank you, little clarification type question to that. Do you see that applying just as much to what one might call negative trauma, i.e. the trauma of deficit of attunement? So there's no template to go back to as opposed to positive trauma later. There's not been a template of attunement established. Is that what you're saying, applicable equally?
Deficits are easier. Sometimes you have a feeling with people that like all you have to do is add water, you know, that they've been parched for so long, and that any amount of genuine empathy and understanding, it's like putting water on a dried out seed and they come to life. I think sometimes that goes smoother than the positive trauma, where relationship is the source of hurt rather than the sustenance.
Mm. Okay.
That's the problem of abuse situations, right? That the very thing that you think you need is the source of the trauma.
Mm. Mm. I think what you're saying sounds quite similar to Kohut talking about, you know, getting the train back on the tracks, but when it's so early that the train never got on the tracks, that it might be a bit of a bigger exercise, but the train can be put on the tracks eventually.
Yes, yes.
Mm, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe one last one. I know Heather has been waiting, so I can finish with Heather.
Hi, sorry, I'll try and make it a succinct question because I know we're nearing the end.
Can you talk louder? I can't hear you.
Oh, sure. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay.
Yeah, you can hear me? Okay. Barry, you had brought up this idea of an inverse curative fantasy, and I've been chewing on that all week since you talked about it last week, and I have a few ideas. I don't want to pollute them with your ideas, but can you tell me what you were getting at with that idea?
You'll have to remind me. What were we?
I was talking about sort of this idea of treating my life like, you know, there's nothing to see here, in this sort of protective way, not wanting, sort of simultaneously hating something about my life and hiding it away. And then my one of my favorite escapes is feminist philosophy and, you know, conceptual thinking, and kind of getting lost in Hagelin's book has been that, you know, a lot of different people have been that. And then your response was to speak about an inverse curative fantasy.
Well, I wish I could reconstruct what I was thinking at the time, but I can't off the top of my head unless I was thinking of something that on the lines of what's-her-name's book, Cruel Optimism, you know, with that sense of a project or an ideal that actually serves to make things worse rather than better, because you'd always, you're always failing to live up to an ideal. You know, mm-hmm. That's certainly something we can do to ourselves, create an ideal that only serves to prove how wrong or damaged or not there yet we are.
Right.
Maybe it had something to do with that.
Yeah. For me, it was this sense.
That's who it was. Yes.
Who was it? Sorry.
Lauren Berlant, the book Cruel Optimism.
Oh, okay. That's another book I'm going to lose myself in.
There you go.